Thanks for listening to Only a Game. If you love this show, then you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. By supporting your local public radio station, you help us to serve and inform your community. Be informed, be connected, be a part of your public radio. Support public radio by visiting donate.npr.org/onlyagame. Then use the hashtag #YourPublicRadio to share why you support independent journalism. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Dennis Rainier was 10 miles into the Grand Valley Marathon when he was hit. Something struck the top of his head and nearly knocked him over. He staggered for a few steps, then
put my hand immediately to my head, and it was it's just like in the cartoons where you see a guy get a big goose egg on his head when he gets bonked. Well, sure enough, I had a big goose egg on my head.
Only a Game's Shira Springer takes the story from there.
Dennis's head started throbbing, his ears ringing, and his vision blurring. But he looked at his hand and didn't see any blood. So he kept running and thinking,
what's wrong here? I'm like running in mud. Why can't I move? This is not going the way my training has been going.
It was 1978, right in the middle of the running boom, and it was Dennis's fourth marathon. He was in the best shape of his life, and he was confident he would run a personal best at Grand Valley, even though it was unseasonably warm for November in Michigan. But after he was hit, that confidence quickly disappeared.
I was losing about 15, 20 seconds a mile, and I was getting frustrated. The further on I got, the more wobbly I got. I had a little trouble focusing my eyes. And again, I was trying to rationalize what in the world happened here.
Was some kid throwing rocks at runners around mile 10? Could he have been hit by a branch he didn't see? A brick? Finally, Dennis convinced himself it had to be dehydration. He downed Gatorade and defizzed Coca-Cola and dumped water on his head. Nothing helped. He pushed through the pain and the wobbliness as best he could. More than anything, Dennis wanted to finish in 3 hours or better. That would qualify him for the Boston Marathon.
I don't think I'm unique in that drive. And anyone who mentioned the word marathon, the next word would be Boston. Did you go? Have you gone? Can you go? Now, I really had no goals beyond that at that point, just wanted to go to Boston and earn it.
That's why he decided to run the Grand Valley Marathon in the first place. It was a couple hours away from his home in Midland, Michigan, where he lived with his wife, Linda, and worked as a chemist for the Dow Corning Corporation. Grand Valley was a small race, about 300 runners, and the course covered mostly flat, rural roads. At the time, Dennis was 26, and his wife, Linda, was 4 months pregnant with the couple's first child. Linda was waiting for Dennis at the finish just outside Grand Rapids, and she would be waiting for much longer than she expected. Dennis slowed to a walk around the 20-mile mark.
It was only to see if it would clear my head and give me some better focus. But never did the thought occur to me, well, I better sit or quit or take a ride or bail. It never even occurred to me, actually.
And why was that? Why didn't that occur to you?
Well, it's either stupidity or dedication. You can take your pick. Probably stupidity more than anything.
If he'd known then why he was slowing down, Dennis would have dropped out of the race. But all he knew was that walking only made the pain and the dizziness worse. So he started running again. He summoned enough energy to finish strong. He crossed the line with both hands in the air. His time was 3 hours and 9 minutes. Not good enough for Boston. His wife walked over to him.
As she approached me, she had her hands up and was clapping, and then immediately said, I thought you were going to break 3 hours. What happened? I said, I don't know. I feel terrible. I think somebody hit me with a brick.
Dennis pointed to the goose egg on the top of his head. Linda told Dennis to get it checked out by the race doctor, but Dennis was in no rush to get medical attention. He'd failed to qualify for Boston. He was disappointed and hungry. Dennis grabbed a hot dog from the post-race food tent. Then, he started thinking about trying to qualify for Boston again. Eventually, he made his way to the race doctor.
Physician looked at the skull and peeled back the hair and the scalp and probed around and finally said, I see something stuck down in your skull, and it's kind of a shine to it, like a metallic object. I think you've been shot. You better go to the hospital and have the emergency room take a look at this.
Dennis didn't believe the race doctor, but
the thought of a bullet in my head just about brought up the hot dog.
Dennis went to Butterworth Hospital in Grand Rapids with his wife. He still figured he'd been hit by a rock or a brick. Turns out, the race doctor was right. Hospital x-rays confirmed that there was a bullet lodged in Dennis's skull.
I had visions of, you know, a huge army projectile kind of thing embedded in my brain matter as your mind races away with that first kind of news. But I was still just irritated that we hadn't broken 3 hours.
The bullet was a .22 caliber, and it was lodged in the thickest part of his skull, almost flattened against the top of his head, which seems lucky.
Well, I was either incredibly lucky or incredibly unlucky. I guess it's a flip of the coin, isn't it? In the wrong place at the wrong time, but I was certainly lucky they didn't do more damage or hit me in a soft spot, or that it didn't penetrate a little bit further.
The doctor needed to remove the bullet without damaging it, because it was now police evidence.
So he's trying to pull a slug that's embedded in the skull out with plastic-tipped forceps, and now he's got betadine, and it's pretty wet, and he couldn't get a good grip. And he finally got enough of a bite on the bullet and was able to dislodge it and pull it out of the skull.
It took 3 stitches to sew up the entrance wound. The police came and took the bullet and asked Dennis if he had any idea how he got shot. He didn't, and told them,
I know one thing for sure. The bullet was there when I finished the race, and it was not there when I started the race. So they said, okay, thank you, and released me.
He put on some dry clothes, left the hospital, and went to a nearby restaurant.
Well, I was a little late for our dinner with my fellow runners. They were all waiting at the restaurant for me, and they said, what happened? I explained it.
Dennis told his fellow runners about the bullet, and
we had a good laugh about it, and said, and basically shrugged it off as just something that happened, didn't pay much attention to it.
And Dennis was back running the next day. But a few days after the Grand Valley Marathon, he got a mysterious phone call. The man on the other end asked Dennis what he looked like. Dennis asked why the man wanted to know. And the man told Dennis,
well, I was in that race, and I would have been running about your pace. And I have some people that are unhappy with me and out to get me. I just wonder if you bought one intended for me. Now, that was about the scariest thing of this whole thing. Could it possibly have been a deliberate attempt aimed at someone else?
Dennis wanted some answers, so he asked for the police report. The police had examined the mark scratched into the bullet's surface, the way the bullet impacted Dennis's skull, and the way it flattened out on one side, and they determined that
the bullet seemed to have been fired from a poorly maintained gun, a damaged gun, a gun that had been perhaps equipped with a silencer. It did not ricochet off of anything, it just plopped into the head.
The police never figured out where the bullet was fired from, but the marathon passed through an area where it wasn't unusual to find hunters. And Dennis thought he was probably hit by a hunter's errant shot, though he'll never know for sure. News reports about the marathoner shot in the head quickly spread from Michigan across the country. And Dennis couldn't believe all the attention he got, from TV talk shows to radio stations to newspapers. He even appeared on the game show To Tell the Truth. Back in Boston, reporters approached some marathon officials and told them what had happened. The officials figured, without being shot in the head, Dennis would have easily broken 3 hours and qualified. They offered him a spot in the 1979 Boston Marathon. At the Hopkinton start, Dennis lined up wearing a singlet with the words Bullet Man across the front.
Nobody else had earned it, so I took it. I picked up the moniker Bullet Man for a little while, and I wore that to several races. Yeah, it was a bit of a joke on myself, I guess, but I try to take my training and running seriously, but not take myself too seriously.
Over the next 4 decades, he ran 21 marathons and 6 ultramarathons, and a DNF, or did not finish, was never an option.
Believe me, it's really hard to justify a DNF when you've finished with a bullet in your head. So after that race, I don't think I ever failed to finish because it was, what would I say? I got tired? What would I say? I got sore?
Being the Bullet Man pushed Dennis to train harder and run faster. His personal best in the marathon is 2 hours, 37 minutes.
Would I have gotten there without the bullet? It's quite likely I would not have.
Let me get this straight. Getting shot in the head made you a better marathoner.
Yes. Yes.
Post-bullet, Dennis became a patent lawyer and moved to Virginia. Almost 40 years later, he's retired and splits his time between training for his next big race and visiting his 5 grandchildren. As for the bullet, well...
Actually, it's in a little Ziploc baggie, and it has taken several trips to school as show and tell for the kids.
Dennis is still surprised by the attention that followed the Grand Valley Marathon, but he admits...
It's not the kind of thing you read about all that often, is it?
Yeah, I'd be hard-pressed to find another marathoner shot in the head who finishes a marathon.
Yeah, well, it was only 16 miles with the bullet, so it wasn't the whole way.
That's typical Dennis. Now, sometimes he'll deny he's the bullet man. Or he'll try.
I think it'll be on my tombstone.
That story came from Only a Game, Shira Springer. It first aired in April, and we're re-airing it today as part of our Sticky Wicket show. What's a sticky wicket, you ask? Well, it's originally a cricket term. Our friends at dictionary.com define it as, quote, the area of ground around a wicket when it is tacky because of recent rain and therefore does not allow the ball to bounce well. Still confused? Don't worry. All you need to know is that the term sticky wicket has become a metaphor for finding yourself in a difficult or delicate situation. And it's fun to say. Prize fighters find themselves in some tough spots. I don't have to be the one to tell you that. Our next story is about a prize fighter named Billy Miskey. He fought legendary heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey to a draw in 1918. But his name might have been lost to history if not for a 1999 column written by Rick Riley and printed in Sports Illustrated. It's called 'Twas the Fight Before Christmas. And back in 2016, we gave it a double play. That's what we call our occasional feature that turns sports columns into radio dramas.
You can take all your Tiny Tims and your Grinches and your Miracles on whatever street and stuff them in your stocking. The best Christmas story is about a boxer. It starts the day in 1918 when a doctor tells a slender heavyweight named Billy Miskey that his bum kidneys give him 5 years to live, if he's lucky. Turns out he's dying of Bright's disease. This comes as rotten news to Billy, who's only 24 years old and not half bad in the ring. He's good enough to fight guys like future light heavyweight champ Harry Greb twice to 10 round draws, which is sort of like tying with a twister. Still, the doc says if Billy's smart, he'll find a comfortable couch and retire right now. Problem is, almost nobody but Billy knows he's up to his ears in debt, being $100,000 in the hole because the car distributorship he operates in St. Paul doesn't distribute near enough cars. Billy's weakness as a salesman is that he's too trusting. He keeps counting on his friends to pay up, and mostly, they don't. So, Billy keeps the kidney news to himself and decides to continue fighting and paying what he owes. In fact, Billy fights 30 more times after the doc's death sentence, including bust-ups with guys like Tommy Gibbons, who was knocked out only one time in his career, and 3 dances with Jack Dempsey, once for the title in 1920. Dempsey hits people only slightly harder than a bus, and in that title bout he belts Billy once so flush in the heart that Billy goes down for a 9 count. In those 9 seconds, a purple welt the size of a baseball pops up on Billy's chest, scaring Dempsey half to death. But then Billy himself pops up, wanting more. Dempsey knocks him clean out less than a minute later, this time with an anvil to the jaw, as Dempsey is trying to get the fight over before one of them faints, maybe Dempsey.
I was afraid I'd killed him,
Dempsey says afterward. But Billy's kidneys are doing a good job of that all by themselves. By the fall of 1923, Billy is dying fast. He looks like a broomstick on a diet. He's too weak to work out, much less prize fight. The only thing thinner than Billy's arms is his wallet. He hasn't had a bout since January, which is trouble because Christmas is coming up hard. Well, Billy isn't about to face his wife, Marie, and their 3 young kids, Billy Jr., Douglas, and Donna, tapped out for his last Christmas. So he goes to his longtime manager, Jack Reddy, and asks him for one last fight. Reddy says, no chance.
I don't like to say this,
Reddy tells him.
But if you went in the ring now, in your condition, you might get killed.
What's the difference?
Billy answers.
It's better than waiting for it in a rocking chair.
Reddy chews on that for a while and comes up with a proposition.
Do one thing for me. Go to the gym. Start working out. And let's see if you can get into some kind of condition. Then we'll talk.
Billy says, no can do. He says there's no way he can work out. He says he's got one last fight in him, and maybe not even that. A softie, Reddy arranges a November 7th bout in Omaha against a brawler named Bill Brennan, who went 12 rounds with Dempsey, and is still meaner than 10 miles in brand new shoes. True to his word, Billy doesn't get any nearer to the gym than his aspirin bottle. He stays in hiding, slurping bowls of chicken soup and boiled fish, and rarely making it out of bed. But he turns up in Omaha on the appointed night, survives 4 rounds with Brennan, and cashes a check for $2,400. That check buys the best Christmas the Miskies ever have. The kids come flying downstairs in the morning to a Christmas tree, a toy train, a baby grand piano, and presents stacked higher than they can reach. They eat like Rockefellers and sing like angels and laugh all day. Do you know, the only smile bigger in Minneapolis that day than the ones on the faces of those 3 Miskie kids is on Billy's mug. The next morning, Billy calls Reddy and whispers,
"Come and get me, Jack. I'm dying."
Reddy rushes Billy to St. Mary's Hospital, but the doctors can't do a thing. On New Year's Day, 1924, Billy, 29, dies of kidney failure. That's it, really. Except that if you ever pass through Omaha and run into an old-timer, ask him about the prize fight that day. The one that gave Billy Miskie the finish he wanted. The one he won in 4 rounds over Bill Brennan by a knockout.
That's Rick Riley's December 27th, 1999 Sports Illustrated column titled, "'Twas the Fight Before Christmas." Many thanks to the Boston University School of Theater and the acting talents of Tiara Burton, Matthew Salas, and Alex Schneps. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Think of Life Kit as that friend who always has the best tips about everything. How to invest your money, how to get in a good workout, and much more. Life Kit, tools to help you get it together. Check it out in Apple Podcasts or at npr.org/lifekit.
I'm Karen Given.
We're now ready to move into the Texas oil fields. For the cause.
For the cause.
This is a scene from the 1941 serial western, King of the Texas Rangers. It's your basic cowboys versus Nazis story. Nazis try to sabotage the oil fields. Cowboys try to stop them.
The governor and I have discussed your request to become a Texas Ranger.
Yes, sir.
The actor playing that polite young man who wants to become a Texas Ranger was one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, Sammy Baugh. And I know you might think that Baugh's sticky wicket has something to do with those Nazis, but the difficult situation he faced came much earlier when he was introduced to football fans in Washington, D.C. Because from the day he entered the NFL, Baugh was being branded as something he wasn't, a cowboy. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
23 years ago, sports writer Dan Daly flew to Dallas and started driving west on Highway 20 toward a part of Texas called the Big Empty. He was searching for 81-year-old Sammy Baugh. It had been decades since Baugh retired from the NFL as the all-time leader in passing yards and touchdowns, and he hadn't been seen outside of Texas in years.
I've got my directions scribbled down on a sheet of paper, and I'm praying to God they're right. Because some of them sound really, really bizarre, you know, like take a left at State Route 580, and I'm thinking, what if there's no sign? What if I just drive forever and end up in Nebraska or something?
Eventually, Daly turned down a dirt driveway. All around him, it was flat as far as the eye could see. The driveway led to a little white house.
I was surprised how small a place it was. And I knocked on the door, No one came to the door. So I go around to the other side of the house to see if there's a window I can look in to see if there's anybody there. And I see this glow behind the drapes. It's clear that somebody's watching television. So I knock on the window and the drapes spread and there's this big guy.
It was Sammy Baugh. He came to the door. And for the next 5 hours, the two men talked.
Can I turn this down just a bit? That'd be okay? Just so I can tape what you say and not lose anything?
This is from Daly's recording of that 1995 conversation.
Is that okay?
Punch your own button. There we go, great.
Until Daly shared his mini cassettes with me last year, no one else had ever heard the recording. For most of the 5 hours, Baugh laughs and tells stories about his time in the NFL, occasionally pausing to comment on the college football game on the TV, and more than occasionally pausing to spit.
He had this gigantic plastic cup with a handle on it, the kind that you get if you're buying like a double gulp, and he used it as a spittoon because he was a tobacco chewer. And every minute or so, he'd lean over and grab the handle and spit into the cup.
And then there was Baugh's language.
Oh, he was mean. You wouldn't think that son was mean, but he was mean.
He didn't have that social filter that many of us have. It tells you that he probably wasn't used to being interviewed all that much.
Sammy Baugh, the greatest quarterback of his generation, the guy who helped make the NFL the forward pass-obsessed league that it is today, had become a reclusive cowboy. This is how that happened. Baugh grew up in a small Texas town. He was far more interested in playing sports than riding horses. He didn't have anything to do with ranching. Baugh was a decent high school football player, but his number one sport was baseball. He played third base and had a great arm. In 1933, Baugh joined the baseball and football teams at Texas Christian University. He expected to play third base and punt for the football team. He'd always been good at that. Most college teams from the East and Midwest were still avoiding the forward pass, but Dutch Meyer, the football and baseball coach at TCU, loved it.
Hell, we could throw the ball anytime we wanted to. And Dutch told us, if you've got a reason for doing it, I'll never second guess you.
Soon Meyer figured out that his third baseman with the strong arm would actually make a darn good passer. During his junior and senior seasons, Baugh led the country in both punting and passing. And that caught the attention of the owner of the NFL franchise in Washington, D.C. George Preston Marshall had a plan for the skinny kid from Texas who the fans and writers were already calling Slingin' Sammy. Washington drafted Baugh 6th overall. And before Baugh boarded the plane for D.C., Marshall instructed him to wear a cowboy hat and boots.
Marshall was such a showman, and he wanted to create this image of the Texan and the cowboy in the minds of the Washington market.
That's Dan Daly again. Baugh wasn't used to wearing cowboy boots. He said they hurt his feet, but he recovered in time to play game one.
Sammy was a sensation. No one had ever seen anybody throw the ball as accurate as he threw it.
That year, Baugh led the NFL with 1,127 passing yards and 8 touchdowns. Washington won the championship. Soon, Baugh was being asked to fly off to Hollywood. Baugh starred in that Cowboys versus Nazis serial, but he kept a low profile in L.A. According to Joe Hawley's biography, Slingin' Sam, Baugh ate lunch on set with the technicians. They had the best stories. At night, he stayed in. Baugh told a magazine writer, "It didn't make sense to be showboating all over Hollywood and spending a lot of money for a steak when I could take that money back to Texas and buy a whole cow." And that's what he did. In fact, he bought an entire ranch 250 miles west of Dallas. He was starting to become a real cowboy. Once World War II began, Baugh's ranch provided beef for the war effort. That meant he wasn't drafted. He kept playing, and during the 1943 season against lower-grade competition, he led the NFL in passing, punting, and interceptions. Baugh played safety, too. In 44, the draft board told Baugh he had to work at his ranch full-time. That was okay with him. He liked the ranch. But he asked if he could still fly to games on weekends. He says the draft board told him,
"You want to go somewhere on weekend? Go." Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, I'll be back Monday morning." He said, "Hell, we don't care." I said, "You get back Monday."
Sammy Baugh retired in 1952 after 16 seasons in Washington. Joe Hawley wrote of Baugh, "What Babe Ruth's home runs did for Major League Baseball, Sam Baugh's passing did for the National Football League." After retiring, Baugh coached for about a decade, but a funny thing happened. The guy who'd once complained about the cowboy boots hurting his feet realized he liked ranching better than football. He started spending all his time raising cattle and roping. In 1963, he was one of two unanimous selections for the Pro Football Hall of Fame's inaugural class. He'd often get asked to attend events at the Hall of Fame or in Washington, but he'd decline. He told Dan Daly he hated wearing suits.
"And it just irks hell out of me to have to go anywhere where I have to put a tie and suit on."
And after all those trips from Texas to D.C., he especially hated flying. So if anyone wanted to see Sammy Baugh, the quarterback who'd changed football, they'd have to go to him. And that's why Dan Daly set out on that journey to the Big Empty 23 years ago to hear Sammy Baugh tell stories.
"Can you tell me much of anything about Ernie Pinkert?"
"Ernie Pinkert, goddamn, you've got a good one there. Ernie Pinkert."
Eventually, Daly realized it was time to go. Not just because 5 hours had passed, but because Baugh had filled his plastic cup with tobacco spit. So Daly started the 250-mile drive back to Dallas. In 2008, Sammy Baugh died at the age of 94. Baugh's ranch is still in operation. His son David is in charge now. I called him up late last year. Could you describe what it looks like out your window right now?
"Well, the wind's blowing, and it's about 35 degrees. It's kind of cold. We've been feeding cattle, and sun is shining brightly, and it's a pretty morning."
David said his father didn't talk much about his role in developing the Forward Pass. He was prouder of his ranch.
"Oh, he was a real cowboy. On his tombstone, it says a pretty good cowman, and that's how he wanted to be remembered."
That story came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. It first aired in December of 2017. Our huge thanks to Dan Daly for sharing his interview with Sammy Baugh. You can link to some of Dan's articles at onlyagame.org. This week's show is all about athletes who found themselves in difficult and delicate situations. And it would be hard to imagine a more difficult and delicate situation than going nose to nose with Adolf Hitler. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Francis F. Baker was born in Buffalo, New York in 1914.
He was a small man. He was 5'7", but he was very interested in sports and very active.
That's Baker's daughter, Jetty Hood. She and her father were fans of the Montreal Canadiens. They would frequently make the trip from their home in upstate New York to Montreal.
Now, my mother wouldn't go because she thought it was barbaric. So he would drag me along. And I really enjoyed it. I had a good time. My father had a good time being very rude to the goalie, Gump Worsley.
Gump Worsley was all-star caliber, an eventual Hall of Famer. Baker's seats at the Montreal Forum were right behind the net. He'd yell at Worsley when he thought he wasn't playing well enough. One night, the Gumper snapped.
Gump came around at the end of the game, and he shook his stick at my father, and he said, "If you think you can do better than that, you get on the ice."
Baker thought maybe he could do better, so he came well prepared to the next game.
My father shows up, and he has his goalie stick and his jersey. And Gump Worsley comes around, sees my father. He bows his head to my father and gave him a grin. And that was the last time he ever complained about my father screaming at him. That would be something he would do. He would stand up for things.
When Jetty was older, she'd learn about another time her father did that. Francis Baker attended Hamilton College in upstate New York during the mid-1930s. He studied the German language, among other things, and he was the goalie for the hockey team. Hamilton head coach Albert Prettyman was selected to lead the U.S. Olympic ice hockey team. In early February 1936, on the eve of the Winter Games at Garmisch-Partenkirchen, Germany, Coach Prettyman had a problem to solve, according to hockey historian Stan Fischler.
The regular goalie had taken sick before they left to take the boat across to the continent. And when that happened, Prettyman got hold of his backup goalie, Francis Baker.
Baker agreed to join the team.
And they arrived in Garmisch-Partenkirchen only 3 days before the Winter Games officially began.
Baker practiced with the team as they prepared to compete amid a political climate in which U.S.-German relations were...
Well, they weren't cordial. Certainly by that time, even though the United States under President Roosevelt was still an isolationist country, the dislike for what was going on in Germany was pretty widespread in the States.
That dislike found its way into the opening ceremonies on February 6th, 1936.
Ich erkläre die vierten Olympischen Winterspiele 1936 in Garmisch-Partenkirchen für eröffnet.
Following Hitler's declaration before a crowd of 40,000 that the 1936 Winter Games were officially open, delegations from 28 nations marched into an open-air stadium. It was a typical display of Olympic pageantry, except for the ubiquitous Nazi flags. Hitler had told the IOC of his demand to have athletes from all nations salute him in the customary Nazi fashion, with right arms extended and rigid.
And the American team did not do that. Their arms were to the sides.
They didn't acknowledge the Führer, and the Führer responded by being furious. So we had a furious Führer.
And that's what triggered Hitler to come down into the locker room.
Hitler and his cadre entered and began to shout at Coach Albert Prettyman and the team.
Hitler berated them, first for the non-salute, and then he very hot-tempered told them that we will beat your American team on the ice tomorrow.
Hitler said all of this in German.
My father, who had studied German in Hamilton College, was requested to do the translating. But when the dictator confidently assured them that they could not expect to beat them in the upcoming contest, my father summed up his courage and mustered his best German to say,
"We will not only beat Germany in hockey tomorrow, in addition, die werden gitten Staaten würden Deutschland immer besiegen. The United States will always defeat Germany." And Hitler was infuriated and conducted an orderly retreat.
Later that day, the U.S. and German ice hockey teams met on Lake Riesersee.
Well, the game was an outdoor stadium in a blinding snowstorm with a throng of spectators, most of them rooting for the home team.
They described the conditions as near blizzard. Baker later explained that it snowed so hard they kept having to stop the game to clear the ice.
The game was close, but the end result, as the brazen young goalie had predicted, was a victory for the USA, 1-0.
The U.S. team went on to win bronze behind Great Britain and Canada. But Baker had made two bold predictions to Hitler. Only one of them had to do with hockey. Baker returned home, finished his undergraduate studies at Hamilton, and went on to earn his medical degree. In 1941, Baker joined the U.S. Army Medical Corps.
He landed on Normandy beachhead on D-Day plus two and followed the GIs to victory over Hitler's Germany in 45. So Baker made good on his boast, the United States will always beat Germany.
Baker returned from the war. For 25 years, he was a respected orthopedic surgeon in upstate New York. His daughter Jetty says he didn't often tell the story about his confrontation with Hitler.
He was very proud of what he did, but he was not a person to drag it out of the closet and show everybody. He was not one to talk about it very much.
Maybe that's why Baker's story has been overshadowed by the many stories told and retold about the Berlin Summer Games of August 1936. But in certain hockey circles, especially the one that encompasses Hamilton College in the quiet upstate New York town of Clinton, Baker's story still shines like a goal light through a blizzard.
As they like to say in Clinton, his most distinguishing moment was his appearance with the team and his face-off with Hitler.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. It first aired in February. We'll have links to more about Francis Baker and Albert Prettyman at onlyagame.org. A couple years ago, a beer league hockey player named Alex Fraycon came across an online invitation to play hockey in North Korea.
I didn't even consider going. It wasn't a thing that I did. I didn't do those kinds of things. Like, I love adventure, but that to me was so foreign.
Coming up, find out what happened when Alex boarded a plane for Pyongyang. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR. Only a Game listeners, have you supported your local public radio station yet? Now's the time. Go to donate.npr.org/onlyagame. Then use the hashtag #YourPublicRadio to share why you support independent journalism. I'm Karen Given. Alex Fraycon is a 30-something copywriter musician living in the Twin Cities. It's hard to describe how much he enjoys playing hockey. Beer league, he calls it. So I figured I'd let him tell you. In song. If Minnesota Nice and hip-hop were to have a baby, and that baby really loved hockey, the result would be the Beer League anthem.
People ask why I still skate at bad rinks when it's real late. Like, every game you get one fan. It's either some dude's wife or a girlfriend.
In March of 2017, Alex Fraycon took a plane to Pyongyang, North Korea, handed his passport over to his tour guides slash minders, and stayed for a week. How did he get such a crazy idea?
Yeah, that's a question, surprisingly enough, I get a lot. I was on the internet, specifically as on this website called Reddit.
Reddit is an online community. People post stories, rants, articles, and web pages they've come across.
And I saw this post that simply said, hey, who wants to come to North Korea to play hockey with me? And I thought to myself, okay, you know, that sounds interesting. Very clickbaity.
The link took Alex to a website for the How International Friendship League, a sports tourism organization based in Canada.
And I X'd out of the window and I didn't think anything of it. I didn't even consider going. It wasn't a thing that I did. I didn't do those kinds of things. Like, I love adventure, but that to me was so foreign.
But somehow, the idea stuck. Alex decided to reach out to the man leading the trip. His name is Scott Howe.
My first email was so overwhelming. So I had questions about the hockey, questions about the travel, questions about the tourism aspect. I mean, it was extensive.
Alex and Scott exchanged 74 emails, and Alex still had a lot of concerns. Here's one you might not think about, unless you're a hockey player.
So the game of hockey, a lot of people who enjoy it, they have a great sense of humor, and they love, you know, it's called chirping, and it's very playful banter. But I was under the impression that, you know, humor was going to be a no-go there. Be prepared to be questioned, you know, be on guard all of the time. Those kinds of things, if that makes sense.
On the other hand, this was the opportunity to play hockey against a national team. Does the North Korean national hockey team have a reputation for being good?
Well, it's a very nice way of you know, asking the question. Let's say their talent has limitations. They're not the best hockey players in the world. Fine. That's fair. But the prospect of playing against a national team, given my skill level, that opportunity is going to come around once in a lifetime.
Alex jokes about his hockey skills, or lack thereof, but he's not a guy who likes to lose. So he looked up some videos of his would-be competition on YouTube.
They were old, but I got a feel. I was like, okay, I can hang. I think we have a good shot here.
Alex says he wasn't really thinking about politics.
Right, right.
Right.
You see, you sound skeptical.
Well, I mean, it's just, it's like, I don't know. I don't even know what I'm trying to say.
I hear you.
I think it would be a hard decision.
It was a hard decision, and I would be lying to you if I said I didn't consider that. And I talked at length with Scott about that. I was like, as an American, there's a lot to be discussed there. To me, the worst case scenario was maybe something is said in the political arena that forces the borders to get shut and I get stuck in this country.
Alex decided to go, but he only told two people, and they're not the ones you might expect.
I did not tell my mom and dad.
As far as his family, his coworkers, and his beer league teammates knew, Alex was going on a tour of China, Beijing, Shanghai, and Hong Kong.
I mean, if there's any kids listening, like, this was bad of me, I would be grounded for this for sure, but I remember having to Google things to do in Shanghai and Hong Kong, just in case people asked me. I could be like, oh yeah, I'm going to see this. It was an elaborate ruse. I know, I'm ashamed.
Alex's days were spent researching and planning, both for the trip he was taking and for the trip he was telling people he was taking. He says he didn't have time to get nervous until he actually boarded the plane in Beijing that would take him to Pyongyang.
The airline I took, I believe it's called Air Koryo, is the worst rated airline in the world.
The flight was uneventful. Alex landed in Pyongyang and breezed through customs. They didn't even look twice at the camera equipment he brought to document his trip, a gallon-sized Ziploc bag filled with his GoPro, extra batteries, and memory cards. In fact, everything went really smoothly until Alex's teammates arrived and 17 strangers had to figure out how to play hockey together.
In an ideal situation, I would have been the worst player on the team, but that was not the case. So we had a great range. We had one individual, I think it was his second time playing hockey ever. And I mean, talk about, you know, confidence. Not only are you willing to try a new sport, okay, but you're willing to try that new sport against a national team
in North Korea. Not long after that revelation, the North Korean team took to the ice for warm-ups. That's when Alex learned how out of date those YouTube videos had been.
Got out on the ice and I was watching them warm up, and they're all skating in one big circle, very, very fast. And then all of a sudden, someone just kind of yells like, "Hut!" And they all stop on a dime, and just snow ominously kicks up all in unison. And I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, we are going to lose. And I went to skate it over to Scott, and I was like, Scott, we are in some trouble. And he was like, oh, no, we'll be fine. Well, spoiler, we were not fine.
All right. Just played our first warm-up friendly game, and we got squashed. What was the final score? 16-1? Something? 16-15? 17? Get him next time.
Alex and his teammates did not get him next time. They lost every single game, and there were a lot of games.
We played about 6 hours a day, 3 in the morning, 3 in the evening. And in between then, we would tour all day. You know, it's nonstop.
Alex had only planned to use his GoPro during hockey games. He didn't think his tour guides would allow him to take videos outside the rink. But soon, he found himself taking it with him everywhere.
I'll admit, I was nervous. Even though they were telling me it was okay, I would always ask permission every time. Hey, can I film this? Can I film this? And they almost started getting annoyed with me because they kept being like, yeah, it's fine.
So Alex recorded his time in North Korea from the 3-lane bowling alley where he bowled with hotel staff to the bus tours of Pyongyang and the surrounding countryside.
Please look at the building on your left. The building on your left is, what is it?
To the dinners, where he and his teammates were entertained with live music.
Asian polka is the best way for me to describe it, but it's awesome.
One day, as the group was visiting Pyongyang's Hollywood-style movie studio, one of the tour guides, her name is Miss Lee, turned to Alex and said,
Alex, did you see what President Trump said? And I just am in my mind, I'm like, oh no. Oh no, what did he say? Please don't let him have said anything about North Korea. And I said, you know, no, Miss Lee, I, you know, my phone doesn't work here. Like, I don't know. What did he say?
Turns out, at least on this day, the president hadn't said anything about North Korea. Miss Lee explained that she'd heard something about the U.S. maybe pulling out of a U.N. humanitarian council. She just wanted to know why. Nothing more ominous than that.
She wasn't trying to communicate anything outside of curiosity. Our tour guides especially were extremely curious about all things United States. They're curious just like I am, and they asked the same questions I would ask.
Alex Fraycon had traveled to North Korea to satisfy his curiosity, but he was also there to play hockey. The last game of the tournament was a mixed team scrimmage. The North Korean players took off their national team jerseys, and everyone put on the jerseys of the Friendship League. Alex says at that moment, the North Korean players, who had been serious and competitive, changed.
Immediately, I was approached by two players from the national team, and they just pointed, you know, one, two, and then at me, three. And they pointed to the ice. And I was like, okay, yeah, we just made a line right there. I think to them, it was like, okay, we're so much better than this kid. We're going to get him to score. Like, that's going to be our joy. So I got this really awesome cross-ice pass and caught this on my GoPro, obviously. I was just watching it. It was a beautiful pass. I kind of had this nice little semi-breakaway. And I shot it right into the goalie's pads.
Bad shot, bad shot.
And so I go back to the bench, and I sit next to a, you know, North Korean player. And I'm just shaking my head, and he's kind of looking at me. And I said, you know, my shot. And I motion with my stick, and then I hit my shin pad. I go, oh, I shot it right into his pads.
Bad shot, not no good. Yeah.
And without missing a beat, he kind of holds up his finger like, no, no, no. And he motions with his hand between his legs. No, no, no. Don't shoot it at the pads. Shoot it between the pads. He started laughing and I started laughing. But I realized, like, I just got chirped by a North Korean national hockey player.
Did you ever think that that would be part of your experience?
No, I never thought that would be part of my experience. And that's why I found it so enjoyable. It was crazy. The love for the game translates across the world.
After his flight back to Beijing, Alex had a more sobering task, telling his parents where he'd been.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear us?
Yeah. And I was like, okay, let's get this over with. So I made a slight change to my itinerary. I'm nervous. I just said,
I was in North Korea the last week.
And then there was silence.
There was a long pause.
And I don't blame them.
Are you guys there?
Did they ever say anything?
I think the first thing my mom ended up saying was, well, that's a goofy thing to do. You know, it definitely deteriorated from that point. Some of my closest friends were, you know, didn't want to talk to me for a little bit. It was, for all of the positives that came out of this trip, and it was a great experience, you know, a lot of people just didn't know how to respond.
With the travel ban, it's no longer possible for U.S. citizens like Alex Fraycon to go to North Korea to play hockey, even if they wanted to.
If, and I'll say if 50 more times, if I were to ever go back, I would have a full and lengthy discussion with my family beforehand. I love you, Mom and Dad. You're the best.
That story first aired in February. In November, Alex Fraycon traveled to another exotic destination to play ice hockey. This time, it was Turkmenistan. He says the experience was, quote, really rad. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.